You're listening to the weekly podcast of Life Ministry Church. We're so glad you've decided to join us. To discover more about LMC, visit us online at lifeministry.church. We pray that today's message encourages you in your faith journey.
This morning we're going to do something different. This morning we're going, or I'm going to interview Marita. And Marita's going to share with you just about Amari, pre-Amari times, her Amari call, establishing Amari, and then what's next for Amari. You know, Marita, unfortunately, hasn't yet received a passport for Jazz to go back to Uganda, which is very frustrating for her because the kids are missing out on school. And the kids are at the moment doing it online, I think. Is that right? Lucky kids. For us, I think it's a great thing because we get the opportunity of hearing her story. The theme that Andy has given us this year, which is fantastic, is called Devoted. And I don't think we could have a better example in Marita of someone devoted to a call that God placed upon her life. Let's welcome Marita as she comes this morning. Thank you. It's a pleasure. So, Marita, tell us a little bit about your life growing up, your home life, your school life. What was it like as a young girl?
All right, so I actually grew up as a member of this church. We started coming when I was about 10 or 12. So this was my home church for most of my early childhood. I also grew up in a very strong Christian family, for which I am grateful for the foundations that have been given to me. I was one of the founding students of Oxley College. School started in year six, and so I came across in year six to start at Oxley, and I had a very happy childhood. I graduated from Oxley College. I was vice captain in my year. We only had a small class of 10 students, most of whom I'm still in contact with today, so that was an excellent connection as well.
So as you think about Oxley and you think about post-Oxley, what was the training that you did after Oxley?
After Oxley, I went on and I did accounting at university, and then I didn't really like accounting, actually hated it, but I'm back to, yeah, I'll use it now a lot, but I hated it at uni. I then went on and did a year of Bible college after uni, which I really loved. And it was while I was in Bible college that I really sat under Ken and Dorothy Gardner, who were doing CRE training with us. And I decided then that I wanted to go back and actually do teaching. So I went back and did my teaching qualifications after Bible college, and then went back to uni and did my dip ed. And then I was employed at Oxley College here as a teacher for my first 4 years.
And she's a fantastic teacher, I can tell you that. So tell us when you first felt you had a call on your life to be a missionary.
Like I said, I grew up in a strong Christian home, and so my parents had a number of missionary books on their shelves, and I was a good reader, so I used to read through those ones. I can remember probably the one that made the biggest impact on me when I was young. It was Through the Gates of Splendor, the five missionaries that were killed in South America. Other books as well, like Amy Carmichael and Peace Child and those kind of things. My grandmother and grandfather on my mother's side were also very into missions, and they always had missionary newsletters and things lying around their house. And so I kind of got used to that as well. My grandma also had a lot of connections with Wycliffe Bible Translators, which is how I ended up working with them in the end too.
Bible College?
Sorry?
Bible College?
I forgot about Bible College. I did my teaching training, and then before I went out, I went to Bible College in between before doing my teacher training. So, didn't I mention that?
No.
Oh, sorry. I did uni, then I went to Bible College, and it was while I was at Bible College that I did CRE with Ken and Dorothy Gardner, and then that's when I decided that I wanted to go back and do teaching, so then I went back and did my dip ed.
Yeah, so you're missing everything that I want you to say. What I really want you to say is I had a picture and a vision.
Oh, okay, yeah, so it was...
Do you remember the vision and the picture?
Yeah, vaguely. I can remember one time in college, I was sitting out at my desk, was outside my room in Bible college, and I just remember having just like I wouldn't even call it a vision, it was really just a picture of working with children, African children under a tree. And I know that sounds very cliched and all the rest of it, but I had this picture and it would have only been for a couple of seconds, but I do remember it quite clearly. And it's actually quite funny because during COVID, our children were not allowed into school. They had to do their classes literally out under the trees in Africa. And so that kind of came to fruition when that happened.
You'll see, yeah, as Marita moves on, that picture is such an important picture and something that's very special when she shares it. But also when the teams go back, we go and see the tree and we see the house that Marita was in. So before you became a missionary, before you went over to Uganda, what was the training that you had to do or did?
I had my teaching background, of course, and I went to Wycliffe Bible Translators. At that stage, we're running a course for literacy teachers, and so their vision was that they would work with local people, teaching them to read and write, but using local language and using the Bible as a source text. And so that really kind of really resonated with me. And so I actually went and did a year's training with Wycliffe, had my teaching background, and so I was asked by a couple of families, would I go over to Uganda and homeschool their children? And so that was my entrance into Uganda. Now, also, when I came back from my first couple of years in Uganda, I knew that I wanted to go back and start a Māori, and so I was actually able to go back to university and on government scholarship, was able to do my master's, and I actually was able to do it in early childhood education because I knew that that's the area that I wanted to start off in, and so that was a real blessing from God as well.
Fantastic. So tell us about the posting, the first posting you had in Uganda.
Okay, so my first posting, I was, you know, people say, how did you get to Uganda? How did you get to Balisa? My first posting was two families that I had studied Bible college with, had studied Wycliffe Bible Translators with, were posted to Uganda themselves. So one was working in the village in Balisa doing Bible translation, and one was working in Kampala doing administration. And so I was sharing six weeks between the two families, helping to homeschool their children. So that was my entry to Balisa.
I think we have a photo of LMC, you being sent out from, yep, LMC.
Dug this one out last night and found it somewhere in my...
She's got a fantastic repository of pictures, I can tell you.
back in 1999 that was, and it was just an indication again of the incredible support that I've had from church family over my entire missionary career.
I remember Mum and Dad talking about how hard it was for them, you being over there, and just the difference between Kampala and Balisa back then. Just share a little bit about the
difference. Probably because I was overdoing it, I didn't really think about the impact too much on my parents and family, but I know it was hard. When I was in Balisa back in 1999, 2000, there was no telephones, and so I would be up in Balisa, and I'd be going for 6 week stints with the only communication I would have was with the family. The only communication with white people was with the family that I was teaching. No communication with anybody else, no communication with home. And it was only when I got back to Kampala, and I think we might have been the very early days of internet and email, that I was able to actually contact my parents. And so I was doing 6 weeks without speaking, and then down in Kampala, and then back for another 6 weeks. Which also happened in northern Uganda as well. Yeah.
I remember rightly you broke your leg when you were over there.
I did.
Tell everybody about how you travel back from Balisa to Kampala with a broken leg.
This is one of those experiences. There's a few times that things really stick in your mind, and I very clearly remember this one. I'd been out walking one day in Balisa, and back in those days it was very, very undeveloped, and I must have twisted my ankle, walked over, twisted my ankle one way and broken my ankle. But we weren't sure for a few days whether it was broken or not. But when the swelling didn't go down, it was like, well, I better get back to Kampala and get it checked out. And at that stage, for some reason, the family couldn't take me down. And so I had to go back to Kampala on public transport. And I can remember they have these taxis in Kampala called Matatus, which are like little mini vans that fit 15 people. And when you're in the village, they'll squash 30 people into these 15-seater taxis. And so I remember sitting up the back of this taxi, supposed to be a 3-seater, but there was 4 or 5 of us against the back. Plus there was a spare tyre next to my leg that was broken as well. So that was like 4 hours down to Hoima. And then when I got to Hoima, I had to get on a big bus that was going to Kampala. Now, these buses were pretty old and rickety and the steps were incredibly high. And I literally had to climb on my hands and knees to climb up these steps to get on the bus to get back to Kampala. And, yeah, that was quite a funny experience.
Now you know why we have our own cars when we go over to work party. What were your thoughts after the year in Uganda? What were you going to do?
I really enjoyed my teaching job, but I always knew that I wanted to work with national children. And so after 18 months, I said to Wycliffe, could I work with national children? But that wasn't part of their, anyway, they said that I couldn't do that because I work mainly with adults at that stage. I know they've changed a bit now. And so because I knew that I really wanted to work with children, I actually resigned from them, and I was able to meet another lady that was working in Kampala who had a couple of schools, one in Kampala and one in Pader in northern Uganda. And so I spoke to her about the possibility of coming back and working with them.
Well, you came back, you did a couple of years of study, further study, and then you went back to Uganda.
Yes.
As principal, just share a little bit about that. And it's important that we look at the photos there because these photos are extremely important there. Just at top page, that one.
So this is the first school where I was working in Kampala. So this was based in Kampala. I loved what I was doing. I was working in Kampala, but also working in northern Uganda, though my heart was really in northern Uganda. But I was working as a principal over the two schools and kind of doing admin, not face-to-face teaching, a little bit of English, but basically admin and principal over those two schools. When I was in Kampala, I met with Emmanuel, who co-founded Amari with us. And there's also another teacher called Akeni who's also on our board, is chairman of our board. So I've made some very good connections in that particular school. And it was also the first time that we had our African... first time that I had a team visit me in Uganda. And this was from LMC. And I think that was Dad and Jim. Is it Jim?
Yep.
Yeah, Jim Culverson and some others that are still here, which was really lovely and a real blessing as well. Okay.
What about the story with the doctor?
This is a good story. I was teaching in Kampala. I had this boy was in senior one or senior two, and then I left sort of around about that time. Anyway, he connected back with me on social media a couple of years ago during COVID, and he's quite excited, and he says to me, "Oh, I'm Wycliffe, and you taught me." And he said, "And you're the reason I'm a doctor." And I was kind of a little bit puzzled, and I said, "Oh, okay." Anyway, apparently when I can't remember this at all, of course, but when I was in this school and he was in the school, I must have lent him the book Gifted Hands by Ben Carson, and he read that book. And anyway, today he is a doctor working in Kampala as well. So that's a really good... That was a good thing, and it was a real reminder to me that it's don't worry about what seed you're sowing and not sowing, or continue doing good even though you don't realise you're doing what you're doing, or keep doing what you're doing because you believe it's the right thing to do, because you never, ever, ever know what kind of seeds you're sowing in the lives of different people. And, so that was a real... that was a blessing to me to hear that one.
So you're in Kampala and then you're up at north in Pader. Just talked about Pader a little bit.
So I was working in Kampala, then up in the north. This was about a six-hour ride out of Kampala. Now, at that time, I was living on the left end of the property on the other side, and the school was on this side here. The road was going down the middle. This was an area called Pader, and it was an area where the LRA, or the Lord's Resistance Army, had been operating a couple of years before. So when I went up to work in this area, it had been pretty quiet for those years. But then I'd only been up there about 2 months and the bombing and things started again when I was there. And so what would happen was the army would, the Lord's Resistance, the LRA, the Lord's Resistance Army, they would form splinter groups and they would move around. And so nobody ever quite knew where these splinter groups were. And what they would do is that they would randomly bomb different vehicles on the road. And when it first happened in June, what had happened was we heard this loud bang. We went outside to have a look, and about 2 kilometres up the road, this the truck vehicle had been bombed, and we could see the smoke rising. And that was the start of the fighting up there again. So I was up there for a few months while the fighting happened. Very, very tense time, a very interesting time for myself. I found it quite... It was unusual for me in that I found that I had an incredible peace. So even though all of this fighting was happening around, I felt like I was in a bubble of God's protection. And what they used to do was they used to lock people in their houses, and they used to lock the houses, and then they used to burn the huts. And so the people inside would get killed. They would also do this with the dormitories of the schools around. And some of you may have read stories about the abducted schoolgirls and those kind of things. And what would happen during those times was the army would make the whole community shut down at 7 o'clock. So we all had to be in our houses, in our huts or whatever, by 7 o'clock. And I was in a room which was between two containers and concrete, so I was perfectly safe. But I can remember one night the medical assistant at the school came over and he knocked on my door about 7:30, so everything was dead quiet and dark. Knocks on my door and he says, "Oh, madame, we've got a problem." I thought, you know, well, there's obviously lots of problems happening. What's this particular problem? And he says, "Oh, the boys in the dormitory, they all want to run away into the bush." And so what used to happen was the men would often run into the bush and hide up in the trees because that was where they were safest from getting abducted from these rebels, because nobody knew where the rebels were going to be attacking next and that kind of thing. And so he said to me, "Oh, the boys all want to run off into the bush." And I can remember thinking, "Okay, God, I didn't sign up for this. I've got no idea what I'm supposed to do. How do I handle this one?" Anyway, I had been reading Psalm 91, which is about the angels protecting us and that kind of thing. And so I actually remember taking my Bible over to their dormitory in the school, and we sat there and we actually read through this scripture. And that particular night, they settled down and they went back to bed. A couple of months down the track, they actually did keep running into the bush, but I wasn't around then. The other thing that my staff used to do was they used to... can we go to the next slide? Is it? Yeah, they used to... So we had shipping containers. This is just not an actual picture, but similar. We had shipping containers covered by roofing. My staff used to take their mattresses at night time, my male staff. They would put the mattresses on top of the containers and they would sleep between the roof and the container, because that's where they felt the safest in case these rebels came to attack. And so this is the kind of thing that was happening. The other one with the gumboots, I had, there was one particular night where we could hear all of the fighting, we could hear a lot of shooting happening outside. We were next to an army camp where all of the people who had been chased from their village farms were living in this army camp next to us. And couple of our workers were living there. In the morning, we got news that one of them was dead, had been killed by these rebels. Anyway, it turns out that they had killed him because the gum boots that he was wearing looked like army boots, and they concluded the rebels that he was part of the army, therefore he had to be killed. And so what our staff then did after that was they actually got all of their gum boots and cut them into strips sort of halfway down, so that anybody that saw them would realise that they were not army, that they were actually just labourers. So this kind of thing was happening, and our people were living in a lot of fear as well. And then this next photo, can we just have a look at this one? Was day after one of the major attacks. I actually went outside, and these men were going around from hut to hut looking at where people had been shot, how many in the households had been injured, and all of that kind of thing. So this was happening sort of on a semi-regular basis during that time. And then the other major thing that happened before I was pulled back to Kampala was one night we'd heard a lot of... there's no telephones at that stage, but there's a lot of radio, what we call radio chatter, and my staff had access to the radios. There's a lot of noise that there were the rebels around our particular area. And so, you know, it was like be on high alert, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, during the night we heard some fighting. Then about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, we heard these enormous boom, boom, booms. And when we got up the next morning, I looked up the road and there was literally, down the road that we were, there was literally hundreds and hundreds, and there was actually thousands of refugees were walking down the road. And what had happened was the rebels had bombed their camp, Atropi it was called, had bombed their camp the night before. This was about the third time that the camp had been attacked. And so these Sudanese refugees had decided, well, this is, you know, we've had enough of this, we've been bombed, we've been attacked, what's the Ugandan government going to do to help us? And so they literally just all got up in a group of at least 10,000 of them, marched down the road. They got down as far as us and they decided that they were going to camp at our place until until something happened. And so they ended up camping on the school property in the compound for a couple of days until the army came in and moved them down to Chirindongo and a couple of camps that were further down in southern Uganda. And so that was that all happened within about from between June and September. And then after that, the organisation that I was with actually made me go back to Kampala for a couple of years. Go back to Kampala for a couple of months before I could go back up again.
So I asked Marita to share all of that because I wanted you to know the training that she's had, but also what she's been through in getting to where she is right now. So often we don't know the stories, and it's these stories that God uses to lay the foundation to give us the faith, the peace, and also the knowledge that he's going to look after us. Good on you, Joyce, for putting up with all of that. Well done. I'm going to move on to the Amari call now.
Sure.
Explain to us just all about the Amari call.
I always knew when I was in Belize homeschooling the children, I always knew that I wanted to come back and work with national children. And I think because Belize was the first rural place that I ever worked in Uganda, that's where my heart always was. And so even when I was travelling up and down to Lira in northern Uganda with the other organisation, we used to pass the road turning off to Masindi and Belisa. And I can remember I often thought, okay, God, how can we get a school started in Belisa? Or how can I get the organisation that I'm now with to do some work in Belisa? And so my heart was always to go back and to do some work with children in Belisa. And when I left, I had to leave the other organisation because there was some things going on that were not ethical. In my perspective, were not ethical or moral. And so I had to leave that organisation. When I left, another two teachers that were working there left as well. And they decided that they would help me form Amari once we decided that we wanted to start an organisation that was going to be working specifically in Belisa. I also had some really good people back home in Australia, like Karen and Felicity and Deb and some of those ones who were praying for us and knew what I wanted to do as well. So that was what was happening then.
So we missed, go back just one step. When you first were over in Belisa with the SIL family,
yes.
You used to teach the SIL family's children, and then after that you went out to...
Yeah, so I think I was teaching most mornings. And so in the afternoons, I'd just pack a bag with some books and some pencils and whatever and just go out. And then a lot of the younger children finished school in the middle of the day in Belisa. And so they would come along, or on Saturdays with some of the older children, I would just go down to the local school and pull out my bag with some books and pencils and just let them, because there's no resources, they didn't have a lot of resources. And so I just let them use my things and do some painting and drawing and things at that stage as well.
So that was the tree that Marita saw when she was in Bible college.
That was a school,
Marita came back from Padar, and she's not going to tell you, but I'm going to tell you, she was quite damaged on the basis that she was let down by the people over there. They morally and ethically didn't operate properly, and it really hurt her deeply. And I know when she came back, she was... quite damaged is the wrong word, but she was under pressure. And yet she still had a call on her life. And I remember probably a year or two after her coming back, her sitting in my office telling me about wanting to go back. And it was then that we decided that Marita should go back and should start a school back in Belisa. She would start it exactly as we did with Oxy College, one class at a time. We said to Marita that we wanted Amari to be a separate organisation, a standalone organisation, not a part of LMC. And the reason for that was that then as God grew Amari, Amari would be a standalone organisation, and whatever happened at LMC or any other organisations or churches that were supporting her, Amari would be supported and Amari would fulfil the vision that God had given Marita. And so Marita went back to Belisa as a missionary from us, starting this incredible school called Amari. So how did you pick the name Amari?
That was funny. We were trying to pick a name that didn't mean anything, and so we looked at a few different names and came up with the name Amali with an L. And so I thought, oh, that's a good one. But when we checked in local language, in Swahili it apparently means intestines. And so we decided that we wouldn't use Amali. But anyway, so we came on Amari and we looked around and it didn't seem to be anything in any of the local languages in Belisa, and nobody put any meaning to it. So we called it Amari. But then I found out later that it actually means I love you in Luo, which is one of the northern languages. And so that's how we got it, and we kind of stumbled upon the I love you bit.
One of the things that was incredibly important before you went back was the Friends of Amari.
Yes.
Let's give some honour to those that really supported you and helped you early.
Yeah, so when I came back, I had this little bit of a dream, but I had some different people like Deb and Carol and Felicity and Sue, Luke Devincentis, my father, a few others, really supported in what I wanted to do. And actually ones like, particularly like Carol and Deb and Sue, really almost drove the vision, because I had a vision but I wasn't quite sure about how to actually go about anything. And at that stage we had no land and no sponsors and no money and, you know, all the rest of it as well. But they had a real belief in what I was doing and were incredibly supportive. Carol came back when I had to go back and confront the ethical situation. Carol, which is a couple of years prior, Carol actually flew back with me as a support, and I think it was the first time that she had actually left Australia. And so she did that. And then when we came back and we were starting to set up Amari, Carol and Deb came across when I was in the village and were up there. Deb did a whole lot of sewing. Carol did some cooking and sewing as well. And so that was lovely to have them on the ground to see what I was doing.
So Amari was established properly, and that's one of the things that we wanted. We wanted to see you established as a incorporated body in Australia, yeah, and also an NGO.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about establishing that.
Yeah, so Australia was not a huge problem. We just registered the association. Graham and Dad and Carol and Felicity and those ones got on board. That was registered. It actually took a lot longer on the Ugandan side of things. They were a lot... in Uganda, there's a lot of fraudulent charities that run, or people who claim to be charities just to get the money, but they actually set up nothing. And so when we tried to set up in Belisa, we were told that we'd never be able to register and you're just a briefcase NGO. And the lady who was known as the RDC, who had to sign off on a document, told us, it's going to take me a year to read all of your documents and blah, blah, blah. And so it was incredibly frustrating. And, you know, a couple of times I went to register with the district, and the district said to me, no, you've got to go back to Kampala and collect another document. Now, Kampala at that stage was about 8 hours away on public transport, so it wasn't an easy trip. So I go down to Kampala, get the document, and then come back up, and then they'd say, oh, no, it's not this document, it's a different one that you need. And so that was another trip down and another trip back. And I can remember quite clearly after about 6 or 7 months, I was just fed up with everything, and I marched into the LC5, who was the top leader in Belisa's office, and said, I've had this and I'm not coming back and we're going to pull out and blah, blah, blah. And I had a contact who didn't actually know me personally. Reverend Moses was his name, but he knew what we were trying to do in Belisa. And he got on the phone to me. He was a native of Belisa. He got on the phone and he said, cool it and I'll talk to these officials to find out exactly what you need. And so that's what he did. And we were able to then get the paperwork. Also had trouble with the Australian government. The Ugandan government required the Australian government give us a letter of clearance or a letter authorising the organisation. So we went to the Australian embassy, because I was in Uganda, went to the Australian embassy in Kenya, said to them, we need a letter, and they just flat out refused to give me anything. They said, because you are not already working, we can't give you a letter. And I was like, well, I can't work until I get registered, and I can't register till you give me the letter, and you tell me that you can't give me the letter until I'm actually working.
All right, like, Marita, you're getting wound up. Okay. That's in us too. Yeah. If you've ever seen Marita get wound up or blow a cool, you do not want to be anywhere near her,
I
tell
you. Don't.
And so we'll move on quickly from that one.
Yeah, anyway.
So okay, so we're gonna run out of time. I knew this would happen. Let's move quickly now to arriving in Belusa, being sent out, getting the land.
Sure.
Building the first classrooms, the children, etc., and just spin your way through those reasonably quickly.
All right. So when we went to work in Belisa, we actually prayed about three different areas to set up in. So when we prayed, one of the areas was Kisiavi, which we now are, and that's because the children in the primary school had the highest number of registered orphans in Belisa. We looked at another area on the lake called Butiava, which had a lot of cross-generational sex with the fishermen, and there's a lot of child issues in that area. The third area that we looked at was in Guedo, which is where the children had to walk incredibly large distances to school. And at that stage, I didn't realise that it was highly complicated because the land was all communal. So you couldn't just walk in and buy the land off a person. We had to get permission from the entire community and also from the sitting neighbours. And so we were actually able to get land in Kisiavi, which is the area which had the highest number of orphans. And that was a real miracle, in that Reverend Moses, who was working with us, negotiated with the community. That particular community was a lot more forward-thinking than other communities, because we talked to a few other community leaders and they had kind of said, oh, yeah, maybe, maybe, and in the end they just pulled out of any negotiations. But this one had a very forward-thinking chairman and quite a strong community who saw the potential of having a school in their area. And so we eventually got the land in that area as well. It took us 10 years to get the title, but we were able to get the land.
Okay, so let's just whip through the photos a little bit, please, Esty. Just the photo of the couple, generous donations from the Greenwoods, and then the meeting with the community to hand over the money. And then, so go to your first children now, Murray.
Yeah, so our first children, what we did was we worked with our immediate village leaders, and we said we need to select some children of this particular age to come into the school. And so they worked with us and they helped us select about 20, 25 children who we said that we would take in as our first group of sponsored children into the school. Now, at this stage, the classrooms hadn't been built, but we were looking at the selection process for that one.
Okay, move on to your first buildings then.
Sorry?
Move on to your first building.
Yeah, so first building, that was finished it in 2011. That was a real miracle. I'd flown back to Australia sometime the previous year and Pastor Graham had let me speak to the church. I think I was only on the platform for about 10 minutes, but by the end of that service, we already had people saying that they would be willing to sponsor individual children. And Ken and Dorothy Gardner were sitting in that service and they came up to me afterwards and they said, this is before we had paid for the land, before we had the building, anything. They said to me, somebody's given us a donation of $10,000 and we believe that God wants us to give it to you for the first classroom. And so they donated the $10,000 for our first classroom before we had anything. And that was a real... that was a real incredible blessing to me, because when all of the stuff that was happening with being unable to register the organisation in Uganda and all of those things, knowing that God had already given us the first 10,000 was something that really helped me to stick to what we were doing rather than throwing it all in, which I felt like doing for a few times. Yeah.
Okay, so tell us the story about the mud bricks.
With the bricks, what would happen is we would purchase them from Hoima or Masindi. So it would be a 2-hour trip down. You get on the phone, you negotiate you say that you'll pay for the bricks, you get the bricks brought down, but they would come down, they'd throw them off the truck, they'd be broken. The people who sold you the bricks would suddenly get them down there, and then instead of charging you the $250 that you negotiated per brick, they'd say, no, it's now $300 per brick. And there's all of these kind of issues, and the quality of the bricks was also very hit and miss as well. And I knew that the district had a brick machine that made what we call hydroform bricks. And so I said to them, could we borrow your machine to try and make some bricks for the school rather than have to buy them? And the district said, oh, yes, you can borrow it, but you can't use it here because the soil's too bad and it's too porous, and all the different reasons why they hadn't been using the machine. Anyway, they agreed to let us borrow the machine, and we were able to experiment with a few different ratios of the red dirt, the murram, the sand and cement until we came up with a brick that was actually quite a solid brick.
Marita says we, but it was Marita that... She's not a good cook, but she's a good brick maker, okay? And even now that we've bought our own brick machine, and even now around the community are using Marita's recipe for bricks. Yeah. Not for food, for bricks.
For bricks.
Okay. Okay, I think what we might do is go to present.
Sure.
And I'd like you to talk a little bit about present. I'd like you to talk a bit about Jazz and Fausta. And then probably let's finish up with just the work parties and sponsorship and capital.
Sure. Okay, so at the moment now we're sitting on 40 acres, so we're able to get another 30 acres, and the community again agreed to let us have that land. We've now got nursery, primary and secondary up to senior four. Our senior four students who graduate to senior five, or who graduate from senior four, we then send them to other schools in Hoima, or either academic schools or vocational schools where they can continue to senior five and six, because at the moment it's too cost intensive to actually run the senior five and six for us, but we can get them into different schools. We've got the two boreholes, we've got the solar farms, and I've got my own place, so I'm not sleeping in the back of a classroom anymore, so that's a little bit different as well. So that's where we are on the property. Yeah.
Fausta and Jazz.
Fausta and Jazz. Okay, so with Fausta and Jazz, I always knew that I wanted to adopt at some stage, and I felt that God wanted me to adopt, but I didn't want to walk into an orphanage, which is how many people will do it over there, walk into an orphanage and say, I'll have this child or whatever. I said, if I'm going to adopt, God has to very, very clearly put them into my path and make it very obvious that I need to adopt. With Jazeel, my friends who ran a medical centre on the outskirts of Kampala came across him when he was about a year, just over a year old, being looked after by a family, an uncle who had 11 children of his own, and this family was in extreme poverty. And when my friends came across Jazz, he was strong, but he was very malnourished and wasn't in good condition. And they said, can we take him to help look after him? And I went down and I met him. So this is the first photo that I had with him. I met him in the August of 2011. But at that stage, they had another lady working with them who had dreamed that she was given another child to look after a local lady. And so that was all good. But I had, when I met him, I had kind of said to my friend Michelle, I said, oh, well, if you ever need anybody to look after him, I'll take him. But like I said, at that stage, he was already being cared for. And so what happened was about 6 months later in February the following year, I get a phone call from my friend Michelle, and she says, well, you know how you said. What had happened was the lady that was looking after Jazz, beautiful lady, but she had AIDS herself, and so she didn't think that she could handle him for the long-term future. And so that's how I got Jazz. Again, an incredible miracle, because I didn't realise until I got to the High Court in Uganda for the adoption process that single females are not supposed to adopt, or single parents are not supposed to adopt children of the opposite sex. It's against Ugandan law. But there was also a clause in the law that said in the best interest of the child. And because he was so much younger than me, because of our work in Belisa, and because the judge could see that he was already bonded with me, she permitted the adoption. So that was an incredible blessing. Same with Fausta. I got a call from our local police station one day, and they said, can you come up to the police station, and I thought it was to do with another child that we were dealing with at the time. Anyway, I walked into the police station, and Fausta was sitting up against the back wall. She's this little waif of a girl sitting up against the back wall, and she had been found in another village, and the village chairman had brought her to the police because they did not know where her mother was. And so what the police and probation said to me was, can we look after her while they try and locate the mother and find out what her background is? Anyway, to cut a long story short, the mother was located. One of our staff members spotted the mother down in one of the villages a few weeks later. We took her to the police. The police tried to get information from her. She wouldn't speak anything to do with Fausta's history or her history. We took the mother back to our property. We're going to look after her and Fausta together and then also find out, get the mother assessed to see whether there was any mental or physical issues with the mother. The mother just up and disappeared one day, and then so Fausta remained with us and I ended up eventually adopting her. So we believe that the mother was actually quite ill at that stage, either physically or mentally or both, and that she understood that if she left Fausta with us, that Fausta would be well looked after. And so that's how we've come to get Fausta.
Beautiful story.
Yeah.
Okay, so just let's close up and just talk a little bit about sponsorship, about capital, just about the whole of the benefit of having LMC working with you and the things that are happening at the property at the moment.
Yeah, so it's an incredible blessing to have the work parties come because they will handle a lot of the infrastructure kind of stuff like the plumbing and the electricity and the solar farm and all of that kind of thing. And so that's been an incredible blessing, a blessing to me personally as well because I'm quite isolated in Belisa, different now with the internet but still very isolated in terms of face-to-face human contact. And so the team provides a good, or visitors and the team provide a good buffer for that one for me personally as well. My staff incredibly love the team coming. Every year they look forward to it. If I ever want my labourers and builders to get anything done, I say, Pastor Graham said, and they'll go out and they'll do it not because I say, but because Pastor Graham says. So that always works well as well.
I wish that happened here.
With the sponsorship side of things, it's an incredible privilege as well to have people sponsor our children in the village. This particular photo, this is a picture of my friend Sarah. She came out before we'd even started the school, when I was living in Belisa Town. She came out and she went round as we were doing some child selection. She met this boy called Nicholas. And this was way back in 2011. Nicholas has just graduated this year. He graduated senior four this year. He's actually got a higher mark than what we expected him. He'll go on and do vocational next year. And Sarah has faithfully sponsored him right from nursery up to now. He's a young man and about to head off to vocational school. I just want to really, really, really encourage you that if you are helping sponsor a child, you are making an incredible difference, okay? And now I know that because I'm on the ground and I see it, of course. I also will help top up some of our kids in the school who need a bit of extra assistance, or I'll help to pay for some children in other schools. All right, so I believe in it myself, and also my own two children have been educated at Amari, so I believe in the quality of what is happening as well. And yes, there's things that we can do different and better, but you are really, 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 any of you, whether you sponsor with Amari or with other organisations, in education you are making a difference. Okay, now what the child chooses to do with their life is up to them, but you are helping to lay the foundations, and it is incredibly valuable and incredibly important. Okay, and so when you sponsor a child, that will pay for our teachers and pay for their running side of the school and pay for the operations side of things, and then...
Rita, as I knew would happen, we've run out of time and we've still got three pages to go. But I want you to understand how proud we are of Marita and proud of her call, proud of what she's done, proud of what she's established, and also feel very, very honoured that we've been able to partner with her and see lives being impacted and changed. And only God knows what's going to happen in 20, 30, 40, 50 years ahead. But the model of Amari is the same model that we've used here, and yet it's done in an African way, and Marita does an amazing job. Thank you so much, all of you, for your capital support, for your work party support, for your sponsorship report, for your prayers, for everything we do. I think Amari is an amazing organisation. We love it, and we love Marita. Andy, I'm wondering whether, as we close, whether you'd just come and pray for Marita. And Fausta, would you like to come out the front as well? Fausta, I know you don't want to. Fausta, come up here and let Andy pray for you and Mum. Is Jazz here still, or is Jazz gone?
He's down.
He's down. Okay. Andy, Jazz, come down. Let's pray.
Jazz.
There he is.
He's up been the back with the boys.
Up with the boys at the back.
Very good.
Thank Marita. What we want to pray for is also for the passport to come through so that we can get rid of them.
I'm just so encouraged from this morning, and just before I do pray, we can come to church and we can often come and think, oh, God, what do you want to say to me this morning? What do you want to do in me? Like, I need this from you or I need that. It's so easy to think that. But what we have been given today in Marita's example is what it is to say yes to the call of God on each one of our lives. And we all have a responsibility as we leave today to continue to say yes to God's call. So Marita, like we honor Marita, we do. We honor Marita for her obedience and what she's done, but we join with her in praising God for the fruit of that. And yeah, that is the reality for every single one of our lives. We leave here and we praise God for what he's doing in all of their lives. So as I was thinking about you guys and wanting to pray for you this morning, that song that we sung this morning is what I want to pray around, that it would be for his glory and our good. And that would be something that you guys both take on as a foundation for your lives, that it is that your good will come from, first of all, giving glory to God in everything you do. So let's join together as a church. Can we stand, please, as we do this? And can we join together and pray for this wonderful family?
We hope you enjoyed this week's message. If you'd like to hear more inspiring messages from Life Ministry Church, or you would like to know more about us, including service times, events, or what following Jesus is all about, be sure to visit us online at lifeministry.church. Thanks again for listening.